Hello and welcome to A History of the United States, Episode 30, Mount Merry. Remember that this is a podcast which relies on listener support. If you would like to help out, why not consider signing up for membership? For the cost of $4.99 per month, you can have access to the premium feed, which is an extra episode every 2 weeks. We're currently on a series on Aztec social history, which I am particularly enjoying, and would fully recommend purchasing. Aztec society is certainly quite different to what I was expecting before I started this project. A very special degree of sophistication, which doesn't quite leap to the forefront of the general consciousness when thinking of the Aztecs. In March 1627, Bradford was pleasantly surprised to receive a letter from the new Dutch colony, which had been set up on Manhattan Island, at the mouth of the Hudson, the settlement which will become New York, whose establishment we will of course give plenty of attention to down the road. It basically said that since the Dutch and English motherlands were friendly, that they were happy to trade whenever they might wish. A reply was made, and the friendliness was reciprocated, and they told them they would never forget the Dutch kindness they had received during their years there. He just asked them to avoid trading with the natives in Buzzard's Bay, and not to settle in the lands claimed by the Council for New England. The Dutch responded in August that while the King of England could claim the land, the Dutch States General claimed them too. Some English patent would not stop them trading in the lands around Plymouth, if they wanted. That at least was the gist of the letter. It was very pleasant and a polite exchange, even if the content wasn't. Bradford replied, likewise with every courtesy, that they would expel any Dutch they found in their lands breaking the patent. An invitation was made to a trade summit to sort out the details, and a threat was also made about the Virginia fleet and the New England fishing ships. No guarantee could be made over what would happen to the Dutch should they come into contact with either of them. The summit did take place when Bradford received a notification from Secretary de Razies that he was in the area and a trade agreement was struck which would last for several years. It was useful for the English, as they learned quite a bit about the region from the Dutch. For instance, they learnt about Native American money. The Indians used as currency something called either wampum or sewam, a type of bead made from the shell of the quahog. No, not the fictional town in Rhode Island, which is the home of a certain Simpsons ripoff, but a type of hard clam that the fictional town is named after. The clam shells were broken into small pieces, tidied up into regular round shapes, and then polished. Interestingly, to me at least, the most valuable colour of bead was purple. This is because only a small fraction of the quahog shell was purple, making these beads the best. It's funny how this was the case when, back in the Mediterranean, purple was considered the most valuable colour due to the difficulty of making the dye. These coincidences can be quite funny sometimes. I'm going to describe the wampum as a form of money, simply because that is an easy translation. But as linguists know, translation causes problems because a lot of the time it doesn't capture the full sense of what is going on. Wampum was traded and exchanged for goods, so it was sort of like currency, but it had a spiritual and ceremonial use too, and could even be used as a way of recording information. The Dutch sold £50 worth of wampum to the English, although it would be 2 years until the Indians there used them. While wampum was common among the East Coast tribes, and indeed also into the interior, they had not spread further east than Narragansett. Once they started using it, the benefits of it became obvious, and indeed to the Europeans too. It was an issue that, in the New World, they were short on liquid capital in the form of coins, which is why most trade took place through bartering, corn in exchange for furs and other such deals. But the wampum filled this gap in the economy, and would be widely used throughout the 17th century, at one point even becoming legal tender. It would not last into the 18th century, though. By this point in history, coinage was more common in the Americas, and the Europeans, with their advanced production techniques, were able to produce wampum on a far greater scale than the Indians could manage. The result was such inflation that it became impractical to use as currency any longer. But this would not be until quite a ways down the road. At present, the amount of effort required to produce the beads was not worth as much as the wampum was worth. The exchange rate was 6 white beads per penny, and then purple beads had twice the value of white beads. It was more profitable for the English to work in other ways. One effect of this increase in trade was that the Native Americans started buying guns, but we'll deal with this later this episode. The other important event in Plymouth in 1627 was the shipwrecking of the Sparrowhawk, a ship which was sailing from London to Virginia. The people were saved and joined Plymouth, but they did not stay long. There was a scandal involving a servant of one of their leaders, and the group were shortly after moved along. With that out of the way, we can begin looking at the bigger picture for the year. Last week was quite a radical moment in the history of Plymouth. In 1627, 8 leading figures of the colony, Bradford, Standish, Allerton, Winslow, Brewster, Holland, Alden, and Prince, bought out the London merchants from the colony. They would be responsible for the trade which was to be responsible for financing this operation. And taking care of this responsibility is how they became known as the Undertakers. Allerton was sent back to London during the autumn to represent the Undertakers as they made their business. New issues had to be dealt with too. Other colonies were springing up along the New England coast. We've indeed spent a considerable portion of today talking about the Dutch, and this greatly changed the dynamics of the operation. We saw the same thing happen in Virginia when the arrival of a group of German settlers greatly altered the relationship between Jamestown and the Powhatans. We've already discussed how the Pilgrims started to take decisions based on the increased trade competition that was being created, such as trading further afield. This was factoring more and more into their decisions. For instance, they had started trading with the people along the Kennebec River, and they wanted to receive a grant for this land, so they would have the trade. This was the primary reason Allerton needed to go to London. Allerton was well received and received the support of 4 Londoners in their endeavour, attaching themselves to the Undertakers. These were James Shirley, who we've already met, in addition to John Buchamp, Richard Andrews, and Timothy Hatherley. This took plenty of time, though, gathering their support and winning the patent for Kennebec. He wouldn't return until 1628, when he brought back with him someone seemingly at the desire of his friends, one Mr. Rogers, to be a pastor, but it isn't really known why, since he was insane and had to be sent back immediately. Allerton would return later that year back to London in order to expand the Kennebec patent. During this year, 1628, in New England, Standish had another one of his little adventures. A number of small colonies were popping up along the New England coast, but they generally had nothing to do with the Pilgrims. They were Episcopalians, not Congregationalists. But despite a subtle hostility to the Pilgrims, Plymouth did have an aura of authority over the region. It was the first English colony in New England, and it was particularly well organised. So, in June 1628, when the English colonies of the region had a problem, it was to Plymouth they turned. What was this threat? that was so able to alarm the English? Was it Indians? Was it a European power? No. Actually, it was a group of drunks. True story. History is just the best sometimes. So, let me tell you the story of how a bunch of drunks almost destroyed New England. So, we need to go back a bit to explain. In 1625, a colony was set up at the site of the modern Quincy in Massachusetts, just south of Boston, by one Captain Wollaston, a rather highly esteemed man. He found it tough, though, and moved on to Virginia, but a few were left behind, including a certain Thomas Morton, who had been an attorney in London. Morton roused up the servants and promised to make them partners in the plantation, and this he did, after they forced the Lieutenant Fitcher, who had been left in command, out. What follows is one of the stranger incidents I've come across in my studies. The settlement was reorganised along the lines of fraternity and equality. They had a trade with the natives and used the profits to buy rum in large quantities. They planted a maypole and renamed the settlement Mount Merry. Now, this, to me, sounds lovely. A lovely little settlement embodying the bohemian lifestyle. I mean, it wasn't perfect. Rum, rather than the obviously better whiskey, but we're still 250 years away from the founding of the Jack Daniel's distillery, so what are you going to do? This couldn't go on for much longer, though, for the settlement began to attract trouble. The other colonies of the region began to worry about what having this little slice of freedom would do. Would the criminals and fugitives of the region flock there, eventually making it strong enough that it could be a threat to them? I particularly enjoy the irony of this. When you think of all the rhetoric that surrounds the founding of the United States, of looking for freedom from the oppression of the old world, yada yada yada, how funny is it that these new colonies immediately sought to destroy the one that wanted to operate differently? It's a fascinating curiosity. As funny as I find this, I must also point out the more practical complaints made about Mount Merry. The settlers had trained Native American hunters with firearms, and once they knew how to use them, they swiftly abandoned their bows and arrows in favour of the advanced technology. They also traded these weapons to the Indians in large numbers. Having access to firearms was one of the key advantages the Europeans had, so important that King James had forbidden the sale of such weaponry to the Indians back in 1622. And here were a bunch of drunks throwing this advantage away. They had to be stopped before they could destroy New England. So the colonies looked to Plymouth, and Plymouth, as always, looked to Standish. Standish led a group of musketeers to Mount Merry, where they found the men held up in a bunker. It's possible that they could have put up a serious fight, you know, if they weren't a bunch of drunks. They were inebriated when Standish arrived. When Standish ordered them to leave, they just hurled abuse at him, and then stumbled out to meet him. Morton overcharged his gun and pointed it at Standish, intending to kill him, but Standish, who is quickly becoming one of my favourite historical figures ever, just pushed the gun right out of the way. Morton was arrested, but the rest of the colony was left in peace, having been brought to heel. Now, following the account of Plymouth, this would be the point to move into 1629, but I think, instead, it would make more sense to pause the narrative in Plymouth and move slightly north, because you see a rather important event was going to happen in 1628. The Massachusetts Bay Company would be founded, which will, some ways down the line, eventually merge with Plymouth and become the state of Massachusetts. This is really important, and I want to give its foundation some attention, so we'll stop here for this episode, and take that up next time out. If you've enjoyed today's episode, remember you can find us online if you want to sign up for membership. The website is thehistoryofpodcast.com. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/thehistoryofpodcast. Follow me on Twitter, @historyjamie, and send me an email, thehistoryofpodcast@gmail.com. I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.